Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to round one of this total knockout episode of The Cyber Show with your hosts, Helen Cruz, Ed Navard, Andy Farnell. Today in the red corner, the British Post Office.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of The Cyber Show.
Today, we're looking at the intriguing case of the British Post Office scandal and its inscrutable systems.
Well, those are some intriguing words to start with there, Helen. What is inscrutable? What does that mean?
Well, sometimes you might hear about someone's character or what they're wearing is described as inscrutable. Doesn't that seem like a nice thing to say?
Maybe. But in stricter sense, we're saying that something is above criticism, that we can't find fault with it.
Cool. So the post office's inscrutable systems must have been almost perfect, right? All fine and proper.
Not so fast. Being beyond criticism doesn't mean something is good. It's no help when you can't find faults with something. Well, not for software. Engineers don't like inscrutable things. Another word would be proprietary. Inscrutable in this sense might mean private or secretive, but in a deeper sense it means that which is unquestionable.
You mean like unquestionable power or figures that won't tolerate criticism? I know someone got 50 years in prison for criticising the King of Thailand, but in secular, liberal democracies, we tend to frown on personal egotism.
But can systems have an ego?
And be open to scrutiny, because they have integrity.
Or even the most basic expectations of truthfully explaining what it is doing and why.
Well, not having that sounds a lot like tyranny and abuse. So what does it have to do with technology?
That's why we're here. Let's get stuck into this case and find out more. To begin with, what is the Post Office Horizon scandal? In fact, for our overseas listeners, let's just start with, what is the post office? Helen?
In Britain, the post office is a really important thing. Foremost, it's a place like a local shop. British people have a very fond, maybe romantic view of the post office. Postman Pat, Postman Pat, Postman Pat, and his black and white cat. I mean, Postman Pat, and I'm obviously including Postwoman Pat here. He's a bloody national hero. He's up there with Fireman Sam.
So, before anything else, let's just say that the post office is an iconic symbol of British life.
Some people might say the post office is the centre of a community, and in many villages in the UK, it is. But to be honest, these days, that's more likely Tesco. Okay, in reality. So, it's a kind of government shop where you can buy stamps, fill out forms for passports, driving licences and benefits, and you can get money or exchange it. And of course, it's the ideal place to queue up for hours and chat with random locals about stuff. There's also a postal service, so a network of collection boxes and a fleet of delivery vans that fall under the Royal Mail. In the UK, those things are split up now.
So it's more than one company or organisation?
Yeah, it's actually a really complex cluster of companies. Some fully private, some still state-owned and having special powers, some that are spin-offs or franchises. From the government's own document, Royal Mail Mythbusters, Royal Mail and the Post Office are separate companies with independent boards. Royal Mail is the company that delivers parcels and letters, the provider of the Universal Postal Service. The Post Office is the nationwide network of branches offering a range of postal, government and financial services. Post Office Limited is a retail post office company in the United Kingdom that provides a wide range of products, including postage stamps and banking to the public through its nationwide network of around 11,500 post office branches. Most of these branch post offices, 99%, are run by franchise partners or by independent business people known as sub-postmasters. The remaining 1% are directly managed by Post Office Limited, and these are known as Crown Post Offices.
And this scandal concerns those franchises or sub-post offices that are local high street premises?
That's right. The small town and village post offices that are run by local shopkeepers, they're called sub-postmasters. Firstly, in those sorts of communities, it's a job that earns a lot of respect. And those that do it are often of the most diligent and community-minded character. I mean, sure, it's a way to make a living, but I don't think that's the big draw. Some people that get into it are nearing retirement. I'm not saying the post office is never busy or demanding, but maybe people taking that job want a slower paced, more pastoral and community-centred life.
That's important, because a lot of what we're going to talk about today is trust and reputation.
Exactly. This scandal cuts to the heart of trust issues, responsibility and openness.
Yes, and to matters of reputation, identity, brands and icons. So talk us through what went wrong.
For 15 years until 2015, thousands of sub-postmasters were wrongfully accused of fraud. Apparently, it was all due to badly written software. The software called Horizon, made by Fujitsu, incorrectly reported accounting shortfalls. But it goes much, much deeper into the people's trust in technology. What really went wrong is that people refused to believe computers could be wrong.
So this is a perennial pattern, the old familiar trope of blind faith in technology that we talk about quite a lot on the show.
And this time, as a result, 700 post workers got wrongful criminal convictions and had their lives ruined. In fact, there were 4 suicides.
Surely, though, if there was a bug, someone would have just looked in the logs and seen it. Fujitsu are a multi-billion pound international corporation with some of the best software engineers. Money can't just disappear. We have a massive financial and government infrastructure to trace money laundering and fraud. I mean, people can't even get away with putting a few extra lattes on the wrong tax account these days, right?
Well, it did disappear, and eventually reappeared in the post office profits. But as for logs, no. Nobody ever said, oh sure, we found a bug and you and 700 other people didn't steal that money. In fact, the post office lied to everyone and told them, you're the only one.
How often do we hear that? The dishonest response every overworked and mostly clueless tech support helpline representative says. It's a kind of normalised gaslighting, right?
Completely. One horrible part of the story is how isolated the postmasters felt. And after broken marriages, suicides, how long it took them to find each other and realise that they were all being strung along. They were led by a quite heroic figure, Alan Bates. And in the end, they found evidence of cover-ups, lies and fraud within the post office.
Let's return to Alan Bates a little later. So one outcome of an earlier round of trials was that over £130 million has been paid out to 2,500 post office workers. But now there's many more claimants lining up. I think a figure of around 3,500 as the total claimants has been mentioned.
Sure, but that doesn't include families and people who have died. There's also a massive PR fallout too. The reputation of the post office has been shredded. And when we look at it, the stated motivations behind this trouble has been to protect that reputation and brand. So it's a good old-fashioned tragedy of hubris. And it raises the question of to protect what? Against overwhelming evidence. Why did Horizon and Post Office hold out for 20 years on admitting a simple bug? What was at stake that's so important?
Can we step back for a moment and talk about sources for this episode? Because it's long running and recently back in the public eye.
Sure. So a lot of what we've been reading is in print or online, and we'll give you a link to references at the end of the episode. A really great overview is the Private Eye in-depth report by Richard Brooks and Nick Wallace. And a very important analysis is in Computer Weekly. Again, Nick Wallace was very early on at this story and has been pivotal in bringing it into view. For a deeper legal read, we've also looked at court documents like Bait and CV Post Office Limited, case number HQ16X01238, and a whole load of Guardian, Times and online forums for computer engineers and security experts.
Great, and let's just say that this is an ongoing investigation, a public inquiry indeed. And so, in the interests of that going well, there are some things that we might want to, but won't say in this episode.
From a socially responsible point, sure. But I think this thing is in full public view now. And besides, we have a particular angle here on the Cyber Show that isn't necessarily about blaming people. It's technology that's on trial, and that's where we're interested. Since the start of this story, it's been the source of a criminal fraud investigation. A parliamentary select committee, High Court appeals, a Metropolitan Police criminal investigation of ex-Fujitsu experts. Witnesses have been accused of perjury and preventing the course of justice. Ministers claim they were lied to. I mean, just the legal cost of society is already in the hundreds of millions. And it's becoming a very public story.
Yeah, there's been at least one documentary and an ITV drama, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. Both are really moving, and watching both together gives a sense of the key topics. Huge injustice, cover-ups, faith in the British justice system.
Which has totally failed.
Well, I don't know if we can say that. It's been agonisingly slow. Stuff around access and funding are unfair and infuriating. But in the end, maybe it will be said that British justice hasn't failed. There are some remarkable heroes in this story, including an extraordinary MP, now a Lord, and some extremely insightful words from judges that we need to talk about. Miscarriages of justice always stir up the public's emotions, but this one is special because everybody can see how easily it could be one of them. When people hear miscarriage of justice, they think that the law got things wrong. A question immediately comes up, which is, did the judges make bad decisions? And it seems maybe the answer is no. The affront to justice seems to have happened long before the cases even came to trial, in the assumptions and social norms around technology.
Okay, so getting a little deeper, let's talk about why we chose this story for the show.
So, obviously a massive miscarriage of justice took place, and people wonder why, who is to blame? And what with the court proceedings being public, the problem lies with the people, in the broadest sense. More than anything, people's relation to technology allowed this to happen. So technology is on trial here.
I chose this topic for an episode because it's something that's in the public eye that makes some super important points about civic cybersecurity. That people cannot trust in technology if they don't know about it. That digital literacy is a foundation if you want to have a technological society. If you want modern cybernetic governance, paperless bureaucracy and so on, you can't allow that technology to become a kind of magic. You can't have people living in deferential ignorance. And because the heroes of this story are basically model hackers, in the truest sense of the word, they're dogged, thorough, infinitely curious. Alan Bates should probably get a Turing Award if he won't accept a CBE.
Yeah, Bates comes across as quite a formidable figure in the drama. I wonder if he'd come on the show. Let's talk about the ITV drama for a moment. Again and again, we hear the phrase, nobody else has this problem. We've all experienced this, right? When dealing with the representatives of technology, their apparent immediate instinct is to jump to the conclusion that technology is infallible and to engage in victim blaming. Is it still fair to say that sort of attitude is tech help desk culture in general?
Problem exists between chair and keyboard. Have you tried switching it off and on again?
Patronising down-talking and an air of assumed authority that's no deeper than a one-page script.
Sure, but we all know frontline support is a hard gig. There's the question of whether those service reps were authorised to make claims like that, or whether they instinctively took that line, or whether they explicitly instructed to say, basically, you're the only one, and so implicitly, it's all your fault?
I think they were quite technically literate. Aren't there allegations that they had backdoor access to the postmaster's computers and could see and could change and did change the data on the machines?
Yes, that's part of the inquiry. And so I think you're right. The technicians in this case were not just Muppets in an overseas call centre. When they said, you're the only person having this problem, they lied. But why?
So this takes us on to the question of perceived infallibility. Marina Hyde, writing in The Guardian, called it a tale of total corporate psychopathy. They wanted to cover this up so badly. It ends in disturbing accounts of how even though the post office knew they would cause ruin to the lives of those accused, they went ahead anyway. There's evidence of really twisted motives, really vicious stuff. I've got a quote here from someone called Dilly, a PO lawyer, and this is extracted from The Guardian. As the case continued, the motivation of the post office changed, and what they wanted out of the case changed. It was less about making an example of Mr. Carlston and more about sending a message that they were willing to defend the Fujitsu Horizon system. Here's another quote from the same Guardian article. Distraught sub-postmasters were imprisoned while pregnant or still in their teens or on their young children's birthday or in their old age or put in high security jails where they saw and suffered terrible things. At least 60 have died without seeing justice or compensation, and at least 4 took their own lives. The human misery story here is massive, but so are the vindictive motives.
These kinds of things happen when authorities are embarrassed. Consider the Gary McKinnon case or Aaron Schwartz, which both kind of seem typical of the bluster and zealous overcooking of every claim of harm. I think we'll always have this kind of human realpolitik, that the symbols and apparatus of power can't easily be questioned. You know, don't point to the Emperor's new clothes, even if it's a military base that uses Windows XP to keep its stuff on.
Surely a military base would have at least a security level of Service Pack 2.
I don't know. Ask Gary McKinnon. Okay, sure. In our business, we know that a little bit of genuine good faith scepticism and scrutiny is a useful and necessary thing. That's why we still do pen testing and review open source code. But look, even in a modern democracy, where the function of democracy itself relies on questioning the governing apparatus, we see heavy-handed medieval justice whenever it comes to technology. Well, it always used to be the case with anything that challenges the orthodoxy, the king, the church, whatever. That always came with an extra risk of encountering arbitrary power and judgment. Or you could put that down to simple pride and vanity, or making examples of people as power theatre to scare the people. And power likes to be a spectacle every now and again. I mean, that's why we have military parades, right? But this is 2024 now. Okay, sure, don't insult the King of Thailand, but I don't think our King Charlie would send his royal henchmen round so fast. So that's the liberalism we live with. And on the surface, it seems great. Sure, blaspheme, defame the church, make unpatriotic and seditious remarks about your own country. But don't you dare question the machinery of power itself. So I think that personal ego doesn't really account for such resistance. Maybe Fujitsu are a bigger power here than we're noticing. I mean, Fujitsu handle a lot of the IT systems in the UK, not just post office.
I know you think there are aspects of digital technology that have become sacred cows now, because that's where the power is now. Surveillance networks, data sharing, permanent credit records.
Well, exactly. And so people who question technology and its use, well, it's not an easy position. Questions about technology are already much more than neutral, academic and philosophical questions. Technology is a multi-billion dollar industry that reaches into every part of our lives. So if they're scientists and academics, that's easy. They can just be marginalised and mocked. And if they're YouTubers, well, you can cut off their channels. And a lot of people that expose technological wrongdoing end up in jail or in hiding, right? And really, it's not really the content of their revelations that's the problem. It's that they dare to raise questions about the very existence of some systems. Now, I'm not saying that cases like Assange and Snowden and Schwartz and whatever, that they're even similar to or connected to the post office scandal. But I'm saying this raises the spectre of very disproportionate reaction to those who come up and criticise systems. It's like democracy allows us to criticise and choose the people who run the systems, but not those systems. And there's a very good quote. I can't remember where it comes from now, but it's when you get to the top and you finally go into the room where the levers of power all are, and you expect to see loads of people furiously pulling the levers and shouting orders, and everyone's sitting around the outside of the room absolutely terrified, and there's no one's touching the levers of power because everybody's scared of them and no one wants to touch them. I mean, there's a bit of that, right? We can fire a CEO, but have you any idea what it would take to rip up and replace systems of that scale?
So what worked about British justice for me, at least in the dramatisation, is that police acted properly. They wouldn't prosecute. They wouldn't even get drawn in. They were right, because there was never a crime. And in the drama, we hear them saying, nah, it's a civil matter. So what many listeners may not know is that the post office mounted a private prosecution, which is one of their powers. But the very fact that they did that because the police wouldn't touch it already says a lot about how this went wrong.
What I'd also note, Ed, is how British justice can work. You know, it can work because the campaigners were able to drag it all out into the sunlight. Now, I know that might sound like a low bar for justice, but in many countries with very similar coloured flags to ours, those people would have been hounded and bullied into silence. And this shows that doggedly not letting go of things like this can and does work. I mean, maybe that's the British way, hanging on in quiet desperation, but hey, it's a kind of patient, persistent, and ultimately successful justice. Because if you've got just a few people around who are clear in their thinking and won't let go of it, now that's a very powerful thing. There's a wide demographic in that sample of postmasters. So I think it's something that appeals to everyone. You can make a stand and you can get systems to behave themselves. And you can demand systems that work.
And some of the right questions are being asked. One judge asked a very incisive question. What is a brand?
Yes, I think the line might have been, what does it mean to protect a brand? In response to her comment about protecting the brand above everything or at all costs, maybe.
I think that was Lord Justice Holroyd. I think that line of questioning continues, and that Sir Wynne Williams is as sharp with the inquiry, because that's a really fundamental question.
Yeah, that is a fundamental question. What is a brand, and what does it mean to protect a brand at all costs? And do we even want that kind of thing to be acceptable in our society? To place a symbol or a system above the needs and rights of people?
Yeah, I think this gets into the realms of vanity and the normalisation of that in society. And maybe how that ties to technology is with how we end up worshipping systems instead of giving respect to one another, simply as people.
Looking at what failed, we've already got quite a list of precursors. A bug in the system, an inconvenience for a big, powerful organisation, private prosecutory powers, an overriding desire to protect the perceived infallibility of their software systems. What's the missing ingredient?
In the UK, we are seeing an increase in devolution of power. Like my kids' school can fine me if they don't show up. And so much power has been devolved and shifted to corporations.
There's always a problem in how you structure things. Nobody really wants one massive, over-centralised system. But too much delegation? What too much delegation does is it leads to little enclaves of power, little fiefdoms with their own sultans and little turfs to defend, and they end up going rogue and acting almost totally autonomously and being unaccountable. Helen, you mentioned schools, and so I'm thinking of Ofsted right now and the suicide of head teacher Ruth Perry. This kind of thing seems ever more commonplace.
Yeah, sure. Maybe we have a weak public justice system and just too much private power, or de facto private power that pretends to have public legitimacy.
Yeah. For the post office affair, a big practical problem now is simply processing all the appeals. People don't know just how much the justice system is neglected and underfunded. Doctors and train drivers and university professors can make much more of a noise and go on strike, but the legal people seem to stay quieter for some reason. But the courts are already crumbling. And if you want to know more about that, then read the book called How the Law is Broken by an author called The Secret Barrister. It's very good.
bringing it back to, has justice failed? I'm thinking that, yes, judges shouldn't be implicated here, as the court relies on expert witnesses to explain interpretation of evidence. These witnesses were biased or unfit, and the process for selecting them is obviously totally broken. Why wasn't impartial technical assistance or investigation brought in nearer the start?
Hopefully, the public inquiry will get to the bottom of that. But so far, if what you're saying is true, then the power of the British justice system wouldn't have come down on the side of these people and against technology. It clearly has, at last. And in doing so, it raises questions that clearly affect everybody. Those in power, but also the postmasters and other people who are victims of that kind of thinking.
I want to move on to talk about the technical aspects a bit more. Just in case anyone is wondering, weren't these just minor bugs that unfortunately caused a little glitch and it all got blown out of proportion? Here's a quote from Nick Wallace of Computer Weekly. The Post Office Horizon's IT system should, quote, never have seen the light of day, end quote, and bosses at supplier Fujitsu allowed it to be rolled out into the post office network despite being told that it was not fit for purpose, according to a senior developer who worked on the project before it went live, Nick Wallace, Computer Weekly. There was a long list of bugs documented in development files. The system was a complex and frequently changing database sync problem with a central hub linked to frequently offline clients. The whole thing talked through intermediate XML files, just as raw transaction markup, and that led to a slew of versioning and conflict reconciliation logic failures because of concurrency and race conditions. There was improper input sanitization. These are basic schoolboy errors, or they're indicative of a prototype system that would never have even been marked for production. And that makes sense, because as Computer Weekly put it, quote, the Horizon's EPOS system was initially built with no design documents, no test documents, no peer reviews, no code reviews, and no coding standards, end quote. That's what we do when making a first round prototype. Then we go back and formalise the requirement specs. And then we start actually building the thing. I mean, with something as important as this, you'd expect a multi-stage waterfall model for development, right? Here's another damning Computer Weekly quote from former Fujitsu engineer Richard Roll, who said, quote, none of the team had a computer science degree or any degree level qualifications in the right field. It was a prototype that had been bloated and hacked together afterwards for several years, and then pushed screaming and kicking out the door. It should never have seen the light of day. Never.
Just wow. What the actual... Can you just say a bit more for our non-technical listeners about database sync problems?
Well, I haven't looked at the code myself, and I'm not even sure if it's publicly available for review. But I'll take a stab. Sorry for the oversimplifications. So, let's say I have a shop, one where I buy and sell things, and a list of things in the shop, and any money that changes hands. I can write down things I sell, refunds or payouts, whatever, in an accounts book. And let's say there's a network of these shops, thousands of them. The big boss wants all the accounts books to see. But that isn't practical. So instead, he wants a single central accounts book that everybody writes down everything they buy or sell. Before computers, that wasn't possible either, because it's not practical for every postman to travel to Central HQ and enter their accounts. But with computers connected by the internet, you can have this. All the post offices enter their accounts directly into the central system. There's just one problem. How reliable is the internet?
We can do a whole series on that, but in a word, not.
Hello, IT. Have you tried turning it off and on again?
Right. And so the post offices get cut off from the mothership. Now they can't enter their accounts. So, what do? Close the branch and go take the dog for a walk because the computer system is broken? Well, actually, some point of sale systems are really that bad. You need to pause your business if there's an outage, but Horizon aimed higher. And you can do that by temporarily storing accounts in the branch computer and then connecting to the central database when the internet comes back online. When that happens, all the records are aligned or synchronized. And that is the bit that went wrong. Sometimes it didn't update correctly, and that made it look like the post office was cheating somehow. And that's when the post office sent the auditors round. In fact, most of the victims were delighted to see the auditors because they thought they would spot the problems and exonerate them.
Okay, there are so many wrongdoings afoot here. There's the dogged refusal of the auditors to look for software errors, and what you're talking about are crimes against software engineering.
Right. It's how the databases are synchronized that is a horror show. Using temporarily plain XML files that might get mangled and malformed is no way to properly sync databases. Probably the parser choked on lines that had errors or were not properly closed and terminated if there was a power outage while writing. Those sorts of things.
So moving away from technical now, there's obviously a lot of speculation about who is to blame. Was it the software engineers?
I don't think so. Sure, the code is a crime against computer science, as you say. We all write crappy code when it's a first draft. No artist would release a film or a novel as the notes and sketches wrote in the lavatory. So why do we expect software engineers to release half-baked things and fix them while people are using them? The internet and poor cybersecurity have created a culture of fix it in the field, with continuous updates and connectivity being normalized. That legitimizes bad software design. Somehow, management allowed that into production. And then probably that's where they started lying about the provenance and quality of the code, when they realized that they couldn't maintain it.
And then more senior management started lying for them, or with them, and we see a spiral of deception. So the thing we all want to know, and I guess that's what the public inquiry will show, is whether there was a criminal conspiracy. So far, there are only allegations or anonymous remarks going around, but they include claims that meeting minutes about software flaws were shredded, emails and logs deleted, that engineers were instructed to lie in court, and that there was a policy coming from the highest level to sacrifice everybody and everything to hide the error. Is that a criminal conspiracy?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but it doesn't sound good, does it? Please, let's talk about the real bombshell.
Yeah, the back doors, right?
The back doors, yes. I think we can call them that. The system had remote access, but remote to what? I don't know. Maybe just into the main database server, or maybe to the clients.
I would actually presume both, because if I were designing a system with only expediency in mind, rather than ethics, I'd leave the client computers open for remote administration at the OS level too.
I imagine there were multiple levels of remote access, but crucially ones that allowed Fujitsu employees to unilaterally make changes to the postmaster's accounts. They had database access and a whole front end to make it easy for them to modify records, and apparently no oversight.
So how do we know the remote administrators have clean hands? That sounds like a nasty temptation to transfer a few quid to your own personal accounts, maybe via another postmaster who's in on it with you. I mean, people who can take out large sums of cash?
Yeah, sure. But that's a mechanism and motive, but speculation.
I'm not saying that's what happened. Just saying. Us hackers have to think like criminals. There's a dozen angles here for corporate cover-ups. The administrators would be an easy scapegoat. When they got given remote access, they also painted a target on their own backs.
I hear what you're saying, but no. I read that the money went into a single holding account and then went into the post office's profits. But anyway, let's hope that that won't happen and that the engineers aren't scapegoated. By the way, if any ex-Fujitsu hackers want to come on the show and talk about this openly, just find one of our public keys and get in touch securely.
Yep, we'd love to hear credible accounts, which is more than the post office had, right? Andy, you've done a fair bit of research in things like UX, UI and human interfaces and whatnot. Let's talk about user error bias.
Yeah, that is a thing. It's there in those remarks like, nobody else has these problems. So it's a cognitive bias, like any other, selection bias or misogyny, anti-Semitism, any kind of prejudice, right? Only in this case, the bias is against humans in general when considered against machines. So it's kind of close to dehumanisation. The roots can be anything from fear of losing your job to deep ideological ideas about how the system cannot be wrong, to plain vanity and ego about your own creations.
I guess as programmers, we do get very invested in our own work.
People who suffer from user error bias are often quite restricted in their general ability to be critical of technologies. They tend to think that new systems, especially their new systems, can only bring benefits. They hold on to ideas like people should adapt to technology and not the other way around. And in some cases, they're quite fervently religious.
And even decades after Gerald Weinberg introduced the world of egoless programming, I see a lot of it. And we've talked about it in relation to male-dominated workplaces.
But there's a lot of stuff to do with identification and fanboyism, which hopefully I'll be chatting with Kate about later.
Right. There is a lot of toxic psychology around tech as far as user blaming and cognitive ableism is concerned. I think we all saw that in Mark Zuckerberg's famous comment about how his users were, quote, dumb f**ks, end quote. I know that's supposedly an offhand remark taken out of context. Comments like that always are. But it speaks the truth so loudly about how some devs see their users. Of course there's a lot of developers out there who love the people who use their programs, and they work to serve them. But more and more people write code to cynically exploit others, or just don't give a second thought to working for companies that use their code as a way to extract from the vulnerable.
Deception and extraction are not the only games in town.
Andy, you and Kate do a lot of study into the psychology of tech. I've heard you talk about the spiral of silence being a big problem in software development. Can you say something about that? Because I think it's relevant to what we're dealing with here.
Sure. Well, it's an idea from political science rather than experimental psychology, although it does have strong support in experimental psychology with the work of, say, Solomon Asch and other conformity experiments. The spiral of silence is a term given by Elizabeth Noel Neumann to a set of conditions and mechanisms that play really deeply on our fear of isolation. I'll read a little quote to introduce it. A false majority opinion dominates because people are afraid to express well-evidenced contrary opinions, believing that they are in the minority. Meanwhile, a noisy actual minority, perhaps mainstream media reports, or a conspicuous prevalent culture that appears dominant and feels unassailable, that's what gets to have its voice heard. The desire to maintain appearances, to keep up reputation, like brand purity or whatever, and to keep respectability intact, that trumps evidence and curiosity. It does affect people who are more psychologically insecure, such as those in workplaces that breed insecurity. So it's a phenomenon that's backed up by psychological sciences, and Elizabeth Neumann extends it. There's the idea that the power of the group comes from unanimity, and that if unanimity is punctured, the group's influence is destroyed. You see it everywhere, in corporate management culture and political parties. Oddly, in reality, group diversity is a superpower. Have a read of the book Rebel Ideas by Matthew Saeed for some more ideas about that.
So there's a trap, you're saying. Some things must be true because that's what everybody's thinking.
Is that what happened here?
No, what happened here is percepticide, something different.
What's that?
It's just a darker, more active and deliberate manipulation. Spirals of silence happen spontaneously. Percepticide is an abusive manipulation where people are so afraid of stepping out that they literally stop seeing and hearing things that should cause them to act. You get systemic mistrust and all the ethical frameworks break down.
And you think that even though we can expect the post office to find a scapegoat, you expect there's a deep culture of fear there, like in so many organisations that have been taken over by fear cultures.
Maybe, yeah, I suspect that.
I'd like to hear more about that sort of thing, so let's hear from Kate.
What do you think's the role of ego in this? Are women, men, old or young people, or any group any more or less likely to fall for self-defeating egotism?
I don't think that a person's ego has a gender or an age or a religion or a racial group. An ego is part of the psychology. The ego is kind of similar to one's sense of self, and that self is now invested. And so you're talking about sunk costs. It reminds me of things like waiting for a bus, that the longer you wait for a bus, the more kind of invested and the more you don't want to believe that maybe this bus that you've waited 45 minutes for is never coming.
Does that mean that people are being dishonest with themselves very actively?
No, I think that it's something about the unconscious.
Any ideas what is maybe the fear or hope or what structures are working below consciousness that keep you stuck?
Well, I think it's maybe potentially to do with denial. There is something about the moral argument that actually, I think it might have been Fairbairn who came up with this idea that it is easier to take responsibility for something that isn't your fault. And we saw that time and time again in both the dramatisation and the documentary of people being told, well, admit to false accounting and then we won't accuse you of being a thief. And that was a really awful kind of Faustian bargain, but that people were prepared to do that because in a way it was easier for them to admit or wrongly claim that they had done something wrong than admit that actually the system was so appalling. And I think that in a way that's totally understandable, because if it's you who's done something wrong, you can then put it right. And we saw that with Joe, and many of the sub-postmasters paid thousands of pounds to try and repay a debt that wasn't theirs. In a way, it was easier to do that than accept that the post office that was in a power relationship with them were behaving in a completely arbitrary, immoral, illegal, inhumane, appalling way.
They didn't want to destroy that image of the post office that they had. And their denial was, well, it's easier to blame myself.
Yes, but actually kind of the post office in a way representing a figure of authority.
There was false accounting.
Yeah.
It's just that it was false accounting by the computer system.
Yeah.
They couldn't be guilty of it, because guilt involves this concept of mens rea. Whether the person is guilty in their mind, knowing that they've done something, and of course the thing was is that every single one of them was innocent.
Guilt can be a healthy emotion as long as it's thought about and put into context and actually explored. Sometimes excessive amount of guilt might not be particularly psychologically healthy.
Because when we look at the spiral of silence, there's shame plays a really big role in that. The shame of the thoughts of what others think. And so guilt and shame are in a proximity, but they're not the same thing. And people not understanding the difference may lead them into psychological traps like the ones that made victims of the postmasters.
Yeah, if we say that the ego is the part of the psyche that is able to experience guilt and shame, we know that a computer system does not have that function at all. And so you made the point that, yes, this was a case of false accounting, but it wasn't false accounting on the part of the sub-postmasters. It was false accounting on the part of the Horizon computer system. And because it's a computer system, it is not capable of feeling guilt, shame, remorse, making amends. And therefore, it is down to the people who were behind the systems to take on that sense of guilt and remorse and shame.
Let's talk about the word identification. We talked about fanboys earlier and fanboyism, about brands and cults and why people get hooked on symbols that they identify with. When they experience somebody criticizing their chosen symbols, it feels as if that's a direct attack on themselves. So can you just say a little bit for our listeners about what psychological identification is? Why do people invest themselves so much in symbols and objects and brands?
I think that there is something about how if people are quite psychologically vulnerable, they become institutionalized. And so they can't, for example, see beyond their own identity as someone who fills a particular role. So what struck me about both the dramatization and the documentary about the post office scandal is how much the sub-postmasters loved being part of the post office, loved the role that it gave them in the community, and were loved in return. There was a bit about Joe and the community whipping around to give her money to pay the post office money that she didn't actually owe them. But I think that the people on the other side who were trying to defend the post office as a brand were equally invested in their role. That reminds me of an idea of percepticide, because they wanted to protect the post office reputation at all costs, because they were so deeply invested in their role at the post office higher up that they committed percepticide. They failed to see the glaringly obvious truth in a very unconscious way.
So institutionalization,
yeah,
makes us vulnerable.
I think so, yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Feel better already.
Well, that's the end of part one of The Post Office, Technology on Trial. Tune into part two very soon.